It's Chatter on Books, and if you think this introduction is boring, you try writing the copy. I'm Jamie McIntyre. Here's Tori Clark.
Welcome back, everybody, to Chatter on Books. Hope you're doing well, staying healthy. In just a little bit, we're going to be talking to a good friend of mine. I've known her forever, Karen Tumulty, who is a terrific journalist, and she wrote what has got to be the Don't Ever Try It Again biography of Nancy Reagan. And whether you love or hate Nancy Reagan, The Triumph of Nancy Reagan is an amazing book. So we'll talk to her about that. Claude Jennings is doing all the important work. David Aldridge and I have to do a lot of heavy lifting tonight because it's just the two of us. David, first I have to ask you, you were in the PTI anniversary show.
I was, yes.
Of course you were. I got so many emails. I just had a David Aldridge moment. I saw him. They don't even talk about Tony Kornheiser or Mike Wilbon. I saw David in the PTI anniversary show. That was so great.
Another great documentary that David's the star of.
Exactly.
He's not the subject of, but he's the star. I mean, it was The Last Dance, and then that was PTI.
Once again, I'm America's guest.
David, no, you're America's steam sealer, which is a great thing. Okay, but put in sports journalism, put PTI in context. For people who might, of our 9 million listeners, not everybody watches PTI, but put it in context because it was and is an important show.
Well, I think Eric Reinholm, who's the executive producer, the creator of the show, said he wanted to make a show that was Siskel and Ebert about sports. And that's what it is. I mean, if you're old enough to remember the old Siskel and Ebert TV show, where they would come on and they would review movies and they would agree or more often disagree about whether they liked the movie or not. But it was clear in viewing them disagreeing that these two very different people actually cared about each other and cared about each other's opinions a great deal. That's what PTI was for sports, because it's two very different people with very different views of the world and very different views of the sports world, to be sure, talking about the sports issues of the day.
Yeah.
And the fact that the only reason to me that the show works, and it's certainly the only reason that's been on as long as it's been on, is that these are two people that love each other. I mean, I think it's obvious. Yeah. If you spend more than 5 seconds watching the show, these two guys really care about each other, and they have for a very long time. And it's the age old question. How did you become friends with your best friend? I have no idea. It just happened. Yeah. Right.
And that's what happened. They love each other and they have enormous respect for each other.
Right.
But there were also things they did. PTI, tell me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure PTI was the first show that did the clock going down the side.
Yes, yes. Which now seems like a ridiculously obvious thing to do, but that no one had done before PTI did it. So the whole notion of a countdown, we're going to spend 45 seconds on this, and then we're going to go to the next thing, which is a normal part of a producer's rundown on a TV show, is that they have the whole show kind of scripted out.
Right.
They're going to spend X number of time on this, and then they're going to go to the next thing. Well, they just put it on camera. That's all, And so now, short attention span America, as was the case in 2001 when the show began, could devote as much or as little to the show as they wanted. If they wanted to wait 45 seconds for the thing on the White Sox to be over so that they could listen to the thing about the Packers, they could, or they could choose not to. And so that was a bit of genius because it was small bites. It was small chunks.
Yeah.
The longest segment in the show is literally 5 minutes long. And so you don't have to devote a whole lot of time to it, but
it seems so common now, but it was so brilliant at the time.
Exactly.
And including a lot of political public affairs shows have tried to copy it.
Exactly.
And the actual inspiration for this show, Chatter on Books, I don't even know if David and Claude know this, is way back when I was a stupid talking head for CNN. I got really bored being a stupid talking head for CNN. Mm-hmm. And I went to them and I said, okay, I can't keep doing this. It's too stupid, even for me. And I gave them two proposals. One was for a show. This was in 2005, 2006, I guess. And one was a proposal for a show on race. And I said, you have a black host and a white host. And I can promise you on any given day, there'll be 15 things that happen that you can look at through the prism of race. And they looked at me and said, yeah, nobody's going to care about that. I said, okay, I've got an idea for a show about books. And they're really fading out. I said, no, stay with me. Books do not have to be tragic. Books are not always tragic. Mm-hmm. And I said, and there's a treatment written down somewhere. I said, you completely rip off the PTI model.
Yeah.
And you have a couple of people and you make it fast. And you have arguments. You have man on the street. And you have the clock running down the side. And to their credit, and I can see him and I remember his name, but I won't name him. One of the executives gave me a fantastic producer and she put together a really terrific pilot. Mm-hmm. And it was really pretty terrific. And we had the featured authors, Mary and James, and they were outrageous. We're in their house in Old Town and they're drinking. It was great. And the guy who was in charge of the whole thing got in trouble at CNN for what we would now refer to as hashtag Me Too. So there you go. But that was the inspiration for it. And it was the shot clock.
Yeah. Well, but the show, you know, that show still, and that's why all these derivatives are, you know, copies of copies of copies of copies, and none of them are any good, is because the show's about Mike and Tony. That's why people watch it.
Yeah.
That's why they watch it. It doesn't really matter what they're talking about. I mean, that ostensibly is the form, is the purpose of the show, but it doesn't really matter. It's about the two of them yelling at each other.
Yeah.
Well, and I traded text yell at with someone Tony. You care about.
Yeah. I traded text with Tony, just said, hey, congratulations. And he said, of course, because the years don't mean that much to me. And I said, the years matter because to your point, David, the number of shows that have come after that one trying to copy it.
Yeah.
And they've disappeared.
It's just people yelling. It doesn't work. Well, I don't know.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it was the rundown, but then also think of all the yelling and screaming sports shows that came after this. And what I don't, you know, unless you, I guess maybe listen to Tony on the radio before PTI, you didn't realize they did this on radio all the time. And and Tony would always tell stories about how they would do it in the newsroom at the Post all the time. Yeah. And they took it. And it was something that was natural, not manufactured. And now we sit here and we're talking any number of sports television shows, and you've got this manufactured yelling and screaming at each other, and everyone's got the hot take, and everyone's it's like, that's not it. That's not the magic is something that is unique to them. Yeah. And that's why it is what it is. And so the yelling and screaming, you know, it's nauseating to me, and I can't just watch. But those guys, you know, you can, because it's what they do.
Yeah. Yes. Well, and there is such a thing as chemistry. Some people don't want to admit that, but there is such a thing as chemistry.
Yeah, I mean,
and those two guys have it.
Yeah, when you were at the Post in the 80s, and you saw it in the late 80s, early 90s, when I was there, and you would be in on the fifth floor in the back where sports was at the time, and they were doing the show. That was the show even then. And the book world people would get angry and yell, hey, we're on deadline for our once every 3 months deadline that we have at book world.
All right. We're going to go to Karen in just a few minutes. And she right now is listening to this show going, who are these people and what are we talking about? Okay, David, I have two questions for you and then the pop quiz. First off, would you pay $1.4 million for the first edition of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein?
I saw this and no, I wouldn't, but I can understand why others might.
I saw
that story. Yes.
Is there any book for which you would pay a huge sum? Say you just were independently wealthy. Would you pay a huge sum of money for the first edition of any book?
I would have to think about it. The first edition of To Kill a Mockingbird that came off the presses, I guess. Yeah, I probably would. But you know, not offhand, nothing that I can think of immediately springs to mind. Like, oh, God, I would have to have that. But I'm not a collector. I know there are people who collect and they collect first editions, and it would mean more to them than me, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm whatever the reverse of a collector is, that's me.
Yeah,
like, I don't want the baseball card. You know, I don't want the Hummel plate. I don't, you know, if you're cleaning out my parents' house, it's like, just throw this crap out. Nobody wants this stuff. But one of the great ironies about this is that when she couldn't sell the book, Mary Shelley couldn't sell the book because she was a woman. So her husband sells it and nobody really wants it. And so finally this kind of crappy publisher did the first 500 copies. And she got just a pittance of the money that the book originally made.
Yeah. No, it's not scandalous. Well, it's scandalous in the sense that it's awful, but you know, that's what happened, unfortunately, to women authors. And what was it, 1831 when this first came out?
Yeah.
You know, so that doesn't surprise me, I guess, is what I was saying. I was trying to
No first out. Editions here. Okay, you second know? Question. Would you cook anything? Were you a Simpsons fan?
I still
did
am.
Watch the Simpsons?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I never watched it. Claude, did you watch The Simpsons?
Absolutely. I even a younger Claude would sneak in his bedroom and make sure it was turned down so mom, who was very careful about what the kids consumed, didn't know that we were watching that particular cartoon. But yes, absolutely. And even now I monitor to make sure my son does not watch the newer episodes of it because now I'm my mom. And so, yeah, right. Absolutely.
What happens?
Okay. I never watched it. I'm not really sure why. I think maybe when it first came on, it was just a very busy time of life and a busy time of day. And
sure,
I just never watched it. But they have, there's a very popular cookbook now, The Simpsons yes. Cookbook.
Yes.
And it's done very well. And it got this lovely review in The New Yorker. And the woman who reviewed it for The New Yorker said she continued to make things.
Yes. Real recipes, by the way, not fake recipes.
Yeah, no, real recipes.
Yeah.
So the Krusty's Burgers.
Right. Flaming
the
Moe
only
Punch.
One that got my attention was Fiery Moe's. Do you guys know what a Fiery Moe was?
It
looked like a pretty funny episode. But anyways, a Fiery Moe is a drink made out of cough syrup and some kind of alcohol and lighted on fire.
Yeah. Oh.
So there you go.
Sounds like Mo.
Yeah. Okay, David, are you ready for your pop quiz?
Oh, God. Yeah, go ahead. Okay. I said I would do it.
I've got to give the New York Times complete and total credit for this because they, about once a year, they write a great story about these scandals in the French literary world. Yes. And I just started pulling them out and shoving them in a folder. And then I saw another one the other day and I went, oh, my God, this seems to happen all the time in the French literary circles. And it's all around their prizes.
Okay,
David, you have to guess which of these three things has happened in the French literary prize.
This is like wait don't tell me now I'm on. This is awesome.
Exactly. Well, I always tell people for this show we stole from PTI and wait don't tell me.
Okay,
so the Goncourt, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, is one of the top prizes, and in this case a juror is romantic partners with one of the finalists that was chosen for the Goncourt. Okay. And by the way, these finalists were chosen over a lunch of roast duckling with cherries and wine. Only a story about a French literary prize would include what they're having for lunch. So sure. One of the jurors is sleeping with one of the people who's nominated. That's choice A.
Okay.
Choice B, some jurors for the Renaudot, second most prestigious award, admitted crowning a pedophile writer in 2013 because they were friends with him and wanted to cheer him up.
Okay.
Sounds French.
Mm-hmm.
At Grasset, which is one of the top French publishing houses, authors who will be jurors on the big award jurors are given big fat advances to secure their vote. So when a Grasset book comes before them, because they got the big fat advance on their book, they'll vote for that one. So which of those three has happened?
Which of those three, they all sound like they happened. Boy, okay, I'm just going to go process of elimination as I drink my French wine. The sleeping thing, probably too obvious. The pedophile, I actually think it's the pedophile thing, but I'm intrigued by the notion of pure bribery, which is an Olympics thing that happens all the time. How much cash can we give you to give our cup person the gold medal?
Right.
I'm going to stick with B. I'm probably wrong.
Well, you're wrong because it's all three.
Well, I wasn't wrong. I just wasn't right enough.
If you listen to Wait, Don't Tell Me Not, they do that about once every 5 weeks. Trick question. Okay, good job, though, David.
I love it.
Karen Tumulty, welcome to Chatter on Books. You still there, my friend, or have you gone away saying, I want no parts of this?
What I would do, Karen.
What a fun podcast.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. It's nice to see you. How's the family?
Everybody's doing great.
Yeah. Excellent. You've got a big new job. So I've known Karen for 1,000 years, more than either one of us would care to admit. And she started in Texas and she was at Time. And she is now, I want to get it right, the deputy editorial page editor and columnist for the Washington Post.
Indeed. Yes.
Nice. David, did you consort with people like that when you were at the Post?
Oh, no, present company, I'm sure Karen and I would have gotten along famously, but most of the people that you would see as you got in the elevators and going down to the fifth, you know, from the fifth floor down, they did not cotton to people who worked in sports. I'll just put it that way. They would look at you. I mean, I don't want to, I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt and not say that they all thought, what are you doing in this room right now? They actually did think I worked there, but they didn't think my job was especially important.
Okay, so I have two sons, and they think I don't really work at the Post because I don't seem to have any friends on the sports staff.
Ah, so maybe it's turned. Maybe it's changed since I left. That was a while ago.
My kids for many years, Karen, the only reason they would talk to me is because I could say I knew people like David Aldridge and Tony Kornheiser. Really? It's the only conversation
I
have.
Happy to hear that.
Okay, so Karen, we're going to talk about your fabulous book, and it really is just remarkable, remarkable book. But I was looking up because I thought, okay, I know Karen pretty well, but I'm going to look up things. So I knew you were from Texas. I didn't know about your famous fifth grade classmate.
Oh, yes, yes.
Do you love or hate that this gets mentioned all the time?
Oh, no, I do. Bill McRaven, the four-star admiral, he was only three-star, who commanded the raid that got Osama bin Laden, was the Navy SEAL, was, yeah, I believe, the smallest kid in my fifth grade class.
Is that right?
He had a growth spurt in there somewhere, but yeah.
Did you like him?
I adored him. He was and is, you know, just incredibly sweet.
Yeah.
Again, which you wouldn't necessarily think
wouldn't
of.
Necessarily think, yeah.
Someone who it commanded all the special forces around the world. But he is, you know, we've remained friends, and he's just terrific.
Nice. Did you was it true, or I read it on Wikipedia, you took him to the White House Correspondents' Dinner once?
I did. It was the year after. You probably wouldn't remember, but the raid that got bin Laden was, in fact, the same weekend as the White House Correspondents' Dinner that year. So it was sort of fun to take him in a more relaxed setting.
He's a couple of books out, but my favorite one is Make Your Bed. And it's based on a commencement speech he gave, maybe in Texas.
It was at the University of Texas, and I think was a major reason that when they were looking around for a new chancellor of the entire UT system, they thought of Bill.
I'm sure he did a fine job. I always laugh when universities tap former military to come in and be their chancellor, something like that, because it's just insane to think that these people who are so organized, so disciplined, so focused, and you get to academia, which is not. But okay. Tell us what got you from, it sounds like you wanted to be a journalist for a very, very long time. But when you were in fifth grade or sixth grade, was this your career choice?
Oh, no, no. Actually, coming from Texas, when I was in high school, I had every Texas girl's dream, which was to make the high kick team. And I totally washed out of the tryouts. And I was just looking for something to do with that period of the day when I had hoped to be out on the football field. And the newspaper was looking for people. And so that's sort of how I got into journalism. So
what did you like about it?
Every day is different. Do you guys agree?
David?
Of course, every day is different. You start with zero every day. You have to fill it in from zero. Sure. Yeah. Of course.
And there's my entire experience with journalism. One of my many failed jobs was the Washington Star for 2 or 3 years, many years ago. Great newspaper, just no longer. But I still remember like it was yesterday. Because I'm a very results-oriented person. And so every day you finished and you were finished and you had something to show for it. And then you started another day and you knew what you had to do to get through that day. I loved that. I absolutely loved that. It was so great.
Yeah, okay. Well, try writing a book that makes you four and a half years.
We will talk about this massive book, I promise. But talk about the big culture change. You were one of the best, hardest working political reporters out there and covering stuff on a day-to-day basis. Now you're in a very different role. I can't imagine the number of incomings you get every day of people begging to have dreadful pieces or have you write about something they want you to write about in the Washington Post. But what's the culture change like from your previous life and what it's like now?
Well, moving from the newsroom to the opinion section, I still think of myself as a reporter at heart. And believe it or not, I did as much or more traveling as a columnist than I did as a national political correspondent. But now, you know, my main, so I'm still writing once a week, but my main job is to run the editorial board. And it's just fascinating because it's a bunch of very, very smart journalists who get together and decide, you know, the editorial page is the voice of the Washington Post. So we sort of hash out what the, you know, what the editorials are going to be and who is going to write them. And we sort of refine the ideas. And it's just like, you know, a great, it's just, you know, fascinating to listen to smart people talk about important things.
And are all you smart people talking to listening to one another via Zoom these days?
I have begun to go into the office in part because of this new job. I'm going in at least 3 days a week, but pretty much everybody else. I mean, the Washington Post newsroom is an absolute ghost ship. Yeah. And you walk around, and as anybody who's been on a in a newsroom knows, it's full of people leave trash all over the place. So you go to people's desks and you see newspapers from, you know, March of 2020 that say things like Biden sweeps the primaries or oh. Boy, this virus looks scary. It's yeah, I sometimes feel like I those scuba divers who were the first ones to encounter the Titanic must have felt.
And find that stuff. Okay, David, when you were at the Washington Post, did you ever get the urge to run into the editorial side and say, this is what you, because you're a child of Washington. And although you're not and have not been steeped in politics yourself, God bless you, you have opinions. So did you ever think to yourself, okay, when I see one of these knuckleheads on the elevator, I'm going to tell them they ought to be doing X, Y, or Z?
No. I mean, honestly, the editorial page was not something I thought about every day when I was at the Post. It wasn't wasn't top of mind, as we like to say. Nor do I feel especially qualified to be able to talk about the things that are talked about, the non-political things, I think, that are talked about rather regularly. No, that was never a thing for me to do. It was too intimidating just seeing Bradley walking the hallways, you know, like, I mean, and he would come back and talk to us like and Mr. Graham, Donnie Graham would do the same thing because they both love sports. And that was such a rush. You got your fill and you were good. I mean, I was good every time they came through. So, but no, I would never do that. Presumptuous on my
part. Karen, in your time on the editorial page so far, have any sports issues come across?
Oh, yeah. Terrible sports issues like, you know, female gymnasts and just dreadful ones. We also wrote an editorial saying that corporations should pull their sponsorship deals from the Olympics in Beijing. And we get into sports sometimes.
Uh-huh. Good for you. And then your sons will talk to you.
Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Okay. All right, let's talk about this book. So, Karen, I know you're a really smart person and you're aware of what's going on in the world. If you're going to write a massive book, I looked at the number of pages and I've forgotten, but it's a lot. It's over 600.
Did you look in the index first, Tor?
No more, David. I'm too old. I've been out of it for so long, I don't do that anymore. Whatever possessed you to write a book about Nancy Reagan? Because she's been done 9 million times.
Well, not like this.
No, but, of course not. Not like this.
Well, actually, it was Simon & Schuster's idea. My editor there came to me shortly after Nancy Reagan died and said, you know, we're interested in a biography of her. And at the time, I'm such a really sharp political analyst. This is like the fall of 2016. So I think, hey, you know, Hillary Clinton's going to be such a conventional president. I might need an outside project to keep me interested. So that tells you a little bit about my own political judgment. But it did take me 4.5 years to finish this book.
Yeah. Did you know that? Did you know it would take that long?
No, I did not. But the thing about her, and, you know, I wasn't joking saying everything that I had ever read about her painted a picture of this cardboard figure. And it just turned out she was so complex.
Yes.
You know, every time I lift one layer, I find 10 other layers. And so that really was in part what took so long. But, you know, again, she was certainly kept me interested.
Well, it's also your nature to, if you're going to learn about something and write about something, you learn everything and you dive into it. But talk a little bit about the process, because 4.5 years, multiple libraries, lots of travel, I'm guessing a few hundred interviews?
several hundred interviews. And in this situation, and also oral histories, and but in this situation, a lot of the people I needed to get to were well into their 90s. I opened the book with a story that George Shultz, who was the Reagan's Secretary of State, tells me. He was 97 years old when I interviewed him. Nancy Reagan's brother was 95. You know, so I, these were people, you know, in some cases, though, I felt like they were telling me things that they knew they needed to say now, or that they were, they were going to disappear.
What surprised you the most?
What surprised me the most was how absolutely influential she really was. She terrified people in the West Wing. She was a very, very, if she was on your side, you couldn't have a better ally. As George Shultz told me, as Jim Baker, who was White House Chief of Staff, told me, because what people don't really know about Ronald Reagan, they think of him as this kind of affable, genial, that he was a very solitary figure, and he was close to exactly one person in the world, and he married her.
It's they're running through the entire book, and it's fabulous. And your storytelling is so good, Karen. It's an epic love story. It's just an epic love story. And that's what drove her, everything she did. And I felt as though reading this, I feel like I knew a fair amount about Nancy Reagan, but there are levels and details I did not know. But everything she did was motivated by her love for him. And one of the things that struck me, I want to hear you, maybe you can explain why, she was so good at helping him with his work, with his image, with everything around him, and not good at managing her own.
That is, you know, people have asked me, if you could ask her one question, what would you ask her? And that would be it. She was incredibly shrewd about Reagan. She, you know, he had this tendency to always be optimistic and trust everybody around him. She trusted nobody. And if she at any point decided someone had failed her husband, they were gone. I mean, her, as James Baker told me, she had better radar than he did, except when it came to herself. And she kept making the same kinds of mistakes just over and over and over again, whether it was, you know, buying $200,000 worth of White House. She didn't buy, I mean, she did it with private donations, but $200,000 worth of White House china in the middle of a recession, or redecorating the entire White House, or borrowing designer clothes and not giving them back. I mean, it was just one.
Oh, who doesn't do that? I mean, David does that all the time. He gets those designer outfits for that, those red carpet award shows he does, and then just never gives it back.
Twice a month. Three times a month in the winter.
Okay, let's go back. I mean, I just, so many things that, again, I felt like I knew about her, but I didn't. So I knew she came from a very interesting family, and I knew her father, the person she considered her father, wasn't her biological father, Lloyd Davis. And again, people, read this book, the level of detail Karen goes in. You learned that Lloyd Davis as a child was so competitive. He wanted to win the prayer book that was being given out to the kids who were altar boys. It's phenomenal. But her parents' marriage, Edie, her mother, and Lloyd, her father, mirrored the marriage she ended up having with Ronald Reagan, right?
Exactly. She's what you see in their marriage is it's really Edie, her mother, who builds the scaffolding that they rise in Chicago society. Although her father, the man she considered her father, was a neurosurgeon in the 1920s and 30s. I mean, this was a field in its infancy. He was one of the most accomplished surgeons in the country. But it was really Edie, his wife, who was responsible for the success.
But again, given her mother's sophistication and building that framework, you would think Nancy Reagan would have been better at managing it for herself. But she dabbles in all these worlds. She hung out with Spencer Tracy. That I did not know.
That's right. One of my favorite little, so she, her Spencer Tracy owed the Davis family, Nancy Reagan's family, a big debt because he was a violent alcoholic. And when he needed to go somewhere to recover from his benders, Nancy Davis's father would arrange for him to stay in a private floor in his hotel, in his hospital in Chicago. So when Nancy Davis in 1949 goes out to MGM for her screen test, Spencer Tracy sets it up. So this woman is not going to fail. You know, she gets one of the most acclaimed directors and acting lessons. And anyway, so MGM, the big powerhouse of Hollywood studios, gives her a contract. But my favorite little bit of trivia that I came across is that because MGM signed young Nancy Davis to a contract, it's one of the reasons they took a pass on another actress who was acting under the name of Marilyn Monroe. So this was probably the worst business decision ever made by a Hollywood studio.
I mean, she came in touch with some of these people. There's a great photograph in the book, right, of her with Marilyn Monroe.
That's right. I think it turns out that Nancy Reagan herself didn't learn about this until like the 1980s when a couple of the old studio hands told her, hey, did you ever know about this?
Yeah. Okay. Let's take back to an amazing Washington day. And again, I was at the Washington Star at the time, and I thought I knew everything about the day Reagan got shot, but I did not. But David, I'm guessing you were a mere pup in kindergarten or something like that when that happened.
I was 5 years old. No, of course not. I was in high school. I came home. I remember coming home, taking the bus home.
Did they stop class? Did they say something terrible?
No, because this happened in the afternoon.
Afternoon.
Yeah, it was not. It was 1:30 or 2:30 in the afternoon. School's out at 3:00. So no, I mean, school's already let out. But getting home and turning on the TV and going, my God, they shot the president. Somebody shot President Reagan, stunned by that, you know, and then of course transfixed like everybody else for hours.
Okay. Karen, tell the story though. I did not know that she had been told something different than what had actually happened.
Well, everyone thought at the White House, everywhere, they thought the president had not been shot. Ronald Reagan himself thought he had not been shot. The head of his Secret Service detail shoves him into the presidential limousine. And he feels pain in his side, but he thinks the agent has broken his rib.
Right.
And originally they are heading back to the White House. They think the president's fine. That is what Nancy is also first told. But while he is in the car, he begins coughing up blood. And his agent, in a decision that probably saved his life, says, "We're not going to the White House. We're going to GW Hospital." Reagan, when he gets there, is still able to walk into the emergency room on his own two legs. But as soon as he gets in, his knees buckle, his eyes roll back, and he collapses. And what they withheld from the country for a long time was how close to death Ronald Reagan really was. He internal bleeding, he lost half the blood in his body. And it was really touch and go. And that is the sort of scene of carnage that Nancy Reagan sees when she gets to the hospital.
And she had insisted on heading out, even though she was told originally something happened, there was a shooting, but he's okay. But she said, right, I've got to go. And they said, there are people headed to the hospital. And she says, I have to go there. She did have her premonitions. As someone who, I'm not totally into astrology, but as somebody who believes in premonitions, she did have some pretty good premonitions, right?
Well, she was anxious. And I go into her childhood, which is, it's pretty difficult. The first seven of the first 9 years of her life, she was essentially abandoned by her mother.
Yeah.
So where Ronald Reagan was the ultimate optimist, he always thought things would turn out just fine. She went through life looking for the trap doors. You know, the bottom is going to fall out here. I just know it is. And again, that was quite frankly one of the reasons she was so valuable to him.
Yeah.
Because she was so wary that she was just always looking out for the danger signs.
Yeah, looking around every corner. Okay, in the dedication to her own book, which was nowhere near as good as this one, people, she references the problems she had with her children. And I'm paraphrasing and paraphrasing you, which is dangerous, but that the children in their family were almost collateral damage to this epic love story they had. Is that right?
Yeah, I think the dysfunction in the Reagan family was extraordinary. And in part, as Patty, their daughter, would say at her mother's funeral, the two of them were such a closed circle. It was though everyone else floated around outside of this yeah. circle. And so I do return quite frequently to the family dysfunction in the book. I think it was one of the great heartbreaks of Nancy Reagan's life. In her own memoir, she writes, "All I ever wanted was to be a good wife and mother, and I guess I succeeded more at one than the other."
Oh. In some ways, she was very self-aware. In some ways. In some ways.
Yeah.
Okay. I have to tell a Maureen Reagan story.
Okay.
I can't remember if it was 84 or 88, but in those years, I was two, and I was working for John McCain. But you'd also, if you were press secretary on the Hill, you'd get loaned out to the campaign and to the conventions and things like that. And we're at one of the conventions, I don't know which one it was, and they have these big surrogate operations. And the surrogate operations were, it was designed by Jim Lake, who Karen knew, and they were designed to just like run these surrogates around to all these TV stations that were there and try to just keep the media busy, right? Like just keep them out of our hair, keep them busy. And I would always get the mean ones. Like I got Jean Kirkpatrick, I got Maureen Reagan, these kinds of things. And it's time for me to go collect Maureen Reagan to take her to some interview across the Superdome or where we were. And she's got one of those trailers under, you know, back underneath everything and this and that. And I'm heading towards it. And I'm, you know, 5 minutes early as I should be. And as I head near this trailer, it is shaking from side to side. There's noise. There's yelling back and forth. There's stuff being broken. There's an agent standing outside. And I looked at him and I'm terrified. And I said, I'm supposed to get her to an interview. Should I knock on the door? The guy, God bless him, looked at me and he goes, "Ma'am, that's a political decision you're going to have to make."
And what happened?
I just left for 15 minutes and I came back and all was quiet. It was okay. It was all right. Did you like her more or less after you were done, Karen? Maybe you won't say.
I don't think I would have liked to have worked for her or been on her bad side.
Right.
But I did have a real appreciation to how absolutely crucial she was yeah. to his success and to his accomplishments. I mean, I open up one of the great things that I think nobody had ever realized, that she really pushed the entire Reagan administration to the warming of the relationship with the Soviet Union that yeah. ultimately leads to the end of the Cold War. You don't really associate that with Nancy Reagan,
right?
But it was extraordinary. I did not think as I was writing a book about a first lady that I would end up writing about things like intermediate range nuclear weapons.
Yeah. Have you ever sat down and talked with Susan Page about her book about Barbara Bush?
We have talked so much about that. And in part because Susan, seeing me writing my books, thought, well, nobody's ever written one about Barbara Bush. But of course, one of the really funny things is that Barbara Bush and Nancy Reagan absolutely despised each other.
Yes.
And,
so great.
And it's
I'm so happy to hear this story.
Oh, I mean, David took catfights to high, high levels. What was the event where they stuck, where Nancy stuck Barbara Bush and was it Rosalind Carter out in the sun?
Oh, that was at the dedication of the Reagan Library. The two of them are out there roasting in the sun and they just assume it's Nancy's doing.
It's so great. But in both this book and in Susan Page's book, The Matriarch About Barbara Bush, you realize, and I knew Barbara Bush pretty well, it wasn't just they were incredibly important because they supported their husbands and they were there for them and these kinds of things. They got involved in issues. And to your point, you didn't think you'd be talking about intercontinental ballistic missiles, but they get involved in issues. And that, I think, is a surprise to a fair number of people.
Yeah, you know, all the first ladies and so far presidential spouses have all been women, but, you know, each one of them has really had to kind of find her own way into this role. And they've done it with varying degrees of success. But it's a real, and, you know, there's no job description. There's no mandate. Right. There's no portfolio. You just got to figure it out for yourself.
Okay. I agree with you that they, in general, they have to kind of find their way and this and that, whatever. Nancy Reagan knew what True North was from day one. And True North was him.
Her only agenda was watching his back.
Yeah.
Because she thought he was not capable of doing it.
Yeah. Okay, David, as a Washington observer, first ladies, love them, hate them, Nancy Reagan, up, down, in between. She's your kind of gal.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to separate kind of your own personal views about things from, since I didn't know anyone in her circle, certainly didn't know her personally. I'm sure she was a lovely woman in many ways. I would say this as growing up, coming of age in that era, it's kind of to me, there's a couple of things. I was very fascinated to read that she really did influence policy more than anybody knew.
Yeah.
But again, coming from that, then you go, but boy, did they not handle AIDS at all. They just literally didn't handle it at all.
Well, I have an entire chapter in the book on the AIDS epidemic.
Yeah.
And I found documents and interviewed people who'd never really talked about this before. Tony Fauci, I've talked to for quite a while. And while, you know, I do think his handling of the AIDS epidemic is a deep scar on Ronald Reagan's legacy that should never be minimized. But I did find a lot of evidence that she recognized what was going on way before he did. She was trying to move him in the right direction. And the blowback that she was getting in the White House was horrific, including people don't realize how awful people were back then. But at one point, William F. Buckley, supposedly the great intellectual light of the conservative movement, wrote a column in which he argued that HIV positive people should be tattooed to identify them on their arms if they were drug users and on their buttocks if they were gay. I mean, this was considered acceptable thought in Republican circles. So you can see why when Ronald Reagan finally, belatedly in his second term is going to give his first big speech on the AIDS epidemic, Nancy went out and got her own speechwriter because she was not going to allow the White House communications operation that until recently had been run by Pat Buchanan to write that speech.
Oh, God. Well, Karen, the book is absolutely fabulous. And as I said at the start of the show, you might hate Nancy Reagan, you might love her, you might, you know, love or hate Republicans, whatever, but it is a fascinating, fascinating biography. And it's a fascinating look, a different look at that time. I can't say enough about it. And I'm so admiring the work that went into it. Thank you for joining us, Karen Tumulty. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you. It was delightful. Thank you for your interest. And thank you for having me on.
Oh, my God. Absolutely. I hope you're proud of it because it's pretty fabulous. It's really fabulous. Okay, a little bit of housekeeping, and then we're out. We are off next week, and we're back on October 18th with Sasha P. Smith. Claude, tell me if I'm wrong about this. We're going to do a Patreon show for this one.
Yes, so everyone who is a member of Patreon can watch that show live, and the one following that. We're going to do a twofer to make up for September.
Excellent. Sasha P. Smith is this really, and I'll give the full disclosure when she's on the show, amazing young author. This is her first novel. It's called Witch's Haven. It's wild. And she's a really interesting person. So Karen, thank you for being with us. David, thank you. I know you're jet lagged and exhausted, but thank you for being with us.
Right. Claude. Everybody's jet lagged. It's okay.
Thank you for doing all the important work, Claude. And everybody out there, stay well, stay healthy. Thank you for listening. And we'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Bye.
Yeah.
Guests on Chatter on Books are entitled to be entered into a raffle to win a home version of Chatter on Books, which includes a deck of laminated playing cards, a colorful game board, and an hourglass-style timer. Only one entry per person in case of duplicate prizes. Ties will be awarded. Must be present to win.